And there was just almost like this beam of pink loveliness that kind of came shooting out of the box.
Hello, I'm Jessica Cadso-Collins, and this is the Inside the Jewel Vault podcast. Each episode, I ask my guests to choose the 6 gems or jewels they would put into their fantasy jewel vault. I hope you enjoy listening. I am delighted to welcome Robin Hanson inside the Jewel Vault. Originally from Perth, Australia, Robin worked in iron ore exploration and then for a partnership of high-end mineral dealers before achieving her dream role to become curator, minerals and gemstones at the Natural History Museum, London, in 2015. Her first book, Gemstones, a Concise Reference Guide, has just been published by the Natural History Museum. Welcome, Robin. I can't wait to hear what you've put inside your jewel vault for us.
Well, thank you so much, Jessica, for inviting me to come on the show. I'm very excited to be here.
So, Robin, this book must have taken you years to research and to write. What on earth persuaded you to write a book, a concise history on all of the gems? Surely there can't be a more challenging topic.
Definitely challenging. I can say that now I've completed it. I am very proud of it. We had another Gemstones book that was published, I think, back in the 80s through the museum. And our publishing team had been very keen to have the Gemstones book rewritten, sort of brought up to date. And it was something I was quite interested to do because I thought, well, you know, it would be really great to pull together sort of everything that I kind of already know about gemstones that I learned doing my gem diploma and things that I'm learning on the job now that I'm working at the museum, but also just the things that I knew I would learn by researching, you know, each of the different types of gemstones and, you know, interesting facts that I could find out about them to add into the book. So it was an absolutely fabulous experience to write it. Took far longer than I was expecting. I also wrote far more than the publishing team had initially asked for. I sort of thought, oh, I could just, you know, I'll write a bit every day on the train as I commute to and from work. But no, it took a lot more time. And then that, so I probably spent about 3 years putting it all together. And certainly when people sort of say the last 5% takes you 95% of the time, they were definitely talking about publishing a book. That last bit of just putting a book together does take a lot more time than you realise. But actually seeing it all put together has just been, you know, really amazing and a great accomplishment for me. I'm really proud of it.
Well, it should be. It is. It's a beautiful book and it's so packed with information, all of it current and up to date, really well researched. And you just instinctively, even, you know, for someone like me who's a cynical old trade person, you can instinctively trust and rely on the accuracy of everything you've conveyed in there. The photos are stunning. I mean, just getting all, you must have had a whole team of people working on your image research.
Yes, I mean, it was really fun actually to do that. So we have a photography unit at the museum. So I worked with one of the photographers, Lucy, quite a long time over the years. In fact, when we were in lockdown, I was given permission to go in. So I would go in 1 or 2 days a week because it was actually the perfect time because while the museum was shut to the public, I could take lots of the gemstones off display, take them to the photo unit, get them photographed and then get them back on display again. So that was one of the benefits. But it was brilliant. I had a great time looking through the collection and sort of discovering things that I didn't realise that we had that we could get photographed and working with Lucy to get the best images that we could. And then, you know, seeing how they were all, like you said, the book is packed. We put as many images in as we could fit in just to really show everyone, you know, what the different minerals look like when they're cut into gemstones or what they look like in the rough and what they look like when they're treated or are synthetic. So, yeah, it was really fun. Doing the photography bit of it was really fun going through selecting the best specimens to use.
Well, you have. I've just been looking at this is a dream gem fest. So let's start right in with the first piece. Tell us about this amazing item. Is this the piece that you have a bit of a story about?
I do, yes. Yes, so this is a pear-shaped gemstone set into a pendant. And I was thinking when I was coming on the show, I'd listened to a couple of your other podcasts. I thought, right, I need to pick some gems sort of through the history of my life. And I was trying to think what the earliest gemstone is I could think of. And I remembered this iridescent pendant that my mum had, which I thought was a mystic topaz. And remembered playing with it as a child, and it was set in gold, had a gold chain, and, you know, these beautiful rainbow colours, and thinking, gosh, I wonder if that was, you know, one of the gemstones that really got me interested in sort of gems and colour and sparkly things like this. So obviously, being originally from Perth, so my parents are still over there, and I've now lived over in the UK for 20 years. So I sent a message to Mum saying, do you still have this mystic topaz pendant that I remember from my childhood? Ah. And Mum wrote back going, I never had one. I've just looked up mystic topaz and it looks lovely. But no, I never had a pendant. I'm thinking, oh my goodness, there's my whole memory as a childhood based on this gemstone that doesn't exist. So bless her. I said, you know, could you go and look? Because I still have some of my things stored at their house. Could you go and look through my things and just see if you can see this pendant, you know, in my jewellery box there? So anyway, the next day I got back this photograph that's the image that we can see here.
You're sharing.
Of this pendant, which is clearly not topaz because it's got this big conchoidal fracture through it rather than a cleavage. Because I'd remember it being cleaved and sort of thinking, oh, well, you know, she did give it to, you know, myself and my sister, the children to play with, and maybe, you know, letting children play with a topaz gemstone wasn't the smartest if it's got sort of damaged and cleaved. But actually it's this lovely conchoidal fracture means it can't be topaz. So it is paste, and it's the facets on the back have been painted different colours to give it this beautiful sort of iridescent appearance. So anyway, Mum did locate it. So thankfully I hadn't completely imagined it. But perhaps she doesn't recall having it as a gemstone herself, but she thinks maybe because at the time she was teaching gemology that perhaps someone had given it to her as an interesting gemstone, and so she'd shown it to us then, and that's why I remember it. So it is still a gemstone from my childhood. It just hasn't, my memory's not quite the same as I think what the actual story is.
Well, this is even better because we've just discovered not only have you set your mind at rest about the existence of this fantastical object, but now you've found out a little bit more about your early career and your early interests. But we've just discovered that your mum is a gemologist. So tell us about this. There can't be too many guests with mothers who are gemologists.
My mum, so she studied geology at university and then also did gemology. So she didn't become a geologist after uni. She then did a diploma of education, became a science teacher, and then later worked at a university. But I think because she always had that big interest in geology, and then she was involved with the Gemological Association over there and doing teaching and stuff. So I think that's where a lot of my interest really comes from, and that, you know, in my childhood, we go out for picnics up into the hills outside of Perth, and we'd, you know, always be looking at the textures in the rocks and that sort of thing. So I definitely got my love of rocks and gems from my mum, which is great. And then when I went to university, I didn't know what I wanted to do, except it was something in science. My dad is also a science teacher, so definitely science in the blood. And Mum was like, oh, just try one unit of geology. You might really like it. And I loved it. And so that was it. That became the focus of my degree, and sort of went on from there.
But this was the very piece that inspired you in a sort of an interest in sparkly, beautiful gems as opposed to rocks and minerals. But you then mentioned that you went on and worked in iron ore exploration. And then in my intro, I mentioned, of course, that you also work for a mineral dealers. So tell us about that.
Yes. So that
must have been an amazing job.
It was a fantastic job. So I worked for a partnership of high-end mineral dealers, so one here in the UK and one in based in California in the US. And it was a great job. Like it's, I sort of thought I knew a lot about minerals before I started working at the job. And then when I began, I realised that actually I didn't know much at all. There was this whole world of mineral collecting, but also just to learn about all the different minerals, but you know what they look like, what particular locations they come from around the world. And I got to see some absolutely incredible specimens, and we exhibited at several mineral shows around the world. So I got to do a bit of travel as well. So there's the Mineralientag, which is the one in Munich in Germany. There's one at St. Maria Means in France. The Tucson Gem and Mineral Show, which is obviously the biggest one in the world, which happens every year in Arizona, and also the Denver Show. And I also once got to go to a mineral show in Tokyo, which was really exciting. So, yeah, really fabulous job. And spent most of my time here in the UK, and probably about 3 months of the year I was over in California as well with the business partners.
Wow. And big name mineral collectors?
Lots of big name mineral collectors. Yeah, it's quite interesting, actually, the sort of people that you learn who are interested in minerals. So, yeah, but it's, quite an interesting business. I think it is a fairly small community, lots of fun. And because it's people are collecting for their passion. So, and every mineral specimen is unique. So for them, it's that treasure hunt of trying to find that individual mineral specimen that fits perfectly within their collection, which was, really lovely to help, people find that specimen. And also because people collect minerals for so many different reasons, whether it's because they think they just look beautiful, or if they're a systematic collector and they, want to get one of every rare mineral, or they're particularly interested in sort of, the Cornish mines, so they just want to collect Cornish minerals, or so many different reasons that people collect them. It was a really fun job.
It must have been, because you were there for some time, weren't you?
Yes, about 7 or 8 years I think I was working there.
And so you mentioned also that it was based here in the UK with some travel elsewhere and some other time spent in California. So what point did you make the big step to come across all the way the other side of the world, the correct side up in Britain and live here?
So I had already moved to the UK before I worked for the mineral dealers. So I think following when I'd worked in iron ore exploration for around 3 years, and then Perth is quite a quiet city, I have to say. So when you're early 20s, and we had some friends who'd moved to London and were having a great time, and so much to do and see. And also the fact you could travel from London and be in Paris in a different country in 40 minutes was amazing, because Perth is just such a remote city. So we thought, well, perhaps we'll come over for a year for London, get a working holiday visa. So we moved over here, and my husband, my now husband, who I came over with, he got a job working for a company, and I got a job working there as an admin assistant. And then the funny connection with working for the mineral dealer. So one of my friends from university married an Englishman who was also a geologist and then moved over to Perth, and the mineral dealer was one of his best friends. So I sort of got introduced to him. Like at that time, the mineral dealer was looking for someone to come and work for him. So I thought, oh, it'd be nice to look at, rocks again. And so that's how I sort of got that job. And then so at that time I was already living over here. And then would, be based still in the UK, and then a bit of time over in the US.
Well, you did say it's a small world, so there you are. Are any of the pieces in your vault from this time working for the mineral dealers?
Yes. So the second piece I put into the vault is a carving of a mouse, which is ice skating. So when I was over in California, I did get lots of opportunities to go and visit some of the different museums. So down to San Diego County Museum, also to the GIA, to their Carlsbad campus, and look at some of the exhibits there. And also the Bowers Museum. So my boss over in America, they're quite closely associated with the Bowers Museums. And they took me to see this exhibit, which was the exhibit of light and stone. And this was the collection of Michael Scott. So Michael Scott was the first president of Apple Computer.
Obviously one of the most famous of the big mineral collectors.
Yes, yeah. So it does just have an absolutely phenomenal collection. So part of the collection was on display here. This particular one I remember seeing, and in fact my mum was over at the time as well and also came to the exhibit with us. And both of us just remember this gorgeous carved mouse, carved out of agate, and it's got sort of gold whiskers and its shoes, little ice skating shoes in gold, and it's skating on this piece of rock crystal, which is, you know, to represent the ice. And I just remember seeing it, we were like, oh, this is just so gorgeous. And I've just always been really amazed at people who are able to carve these three-dimensional objects out of sort of different rocks and minerals, but make them look like they're alive. Mm. And also, especially with these more opaque materials, you know, not knowing actually what do the colours do in the middle, and yet being able to work that into the carving and utilise that to make these incredible sort of sculptures. So this particular one, so I unfortunately haven't got the credit for who carved it, but I think it's a gentleman, Alfred Zimmerman, who worked under Gerd Dreyer, who's known for very similar sort of animal carvings, and both based in Ida Oberstein. And I've since had the pleasure of meeting Gerd Dreyer's son, Patrick, and hearing him talk at several conferences and, you know, seeing lots of images of the carvings that they've also done. And yeah, they're just so sweet, so many of them with the little mice or frogs and that sort of thing.
They are little works of art, aren't they? And this is just charming, the way that the movement has been captured. I love the way that his whiskers are sort of swept backwards away from his face as he pushes through along the ice with his little tail and a whiplash behind him. It's just adorable.
You can just really imagine, yeah, the movement and the wind blowing, you know, ruffling his fur.
A little yes. Speedy mouse. So gorgeous. Well, no wonder this one's stuck in your mind, because it's totally, you know, delicious. So we have two pieces now that tell quite a lovely story of your early inspiration and fascination with gems and minerals. So that's two pieces. So what's the next item in your vault? It's a little different.
The next one I've chosen is a Paraíba tourmaline gemstone. So I love tourmalines. I would say they're probably my favourite gemstone. I think partly because they come in, you know, so many different colours, but also the fact that you can get the gemstones with more than one colour in them. But I also love blues and turquoises. That would be sort of my favourite colours. So the fact that you get these tourmalines that are this amazing sort of neon blue colour is like the perfect combination for me. And the gemstone that I have here in the photograph, that's my hand that it's resting on. So it's a particularly large gemstone. So I was shown this at the 2016 Munich show. I was walking around with one of our colleagues and talking to some dealers and sort of got shown this. I was like, oh, can I take a photo? And oh, I was just in heaven, just seeing, you know, a gemstone of this size and quality and just magnificent colour. So I thought, yeah, this has got to be one of the sort of favourite gemstones that I've seen. I thought I definitely need to include a Paraíba tourmaline into my vault.
Yeah, I can quite understand. This is exceptional, isn't it? Do you remember the size of it and how much it was worth?
I don't remember the size, and I had a look to see if I had a notebook where I might have written it down, but I couldn't find anything, unfortunately. And the price was definitely, it was one of those, you don't ask the price.
But no, if you had asked the price, they probably wouldn't have allowed you out of the stand, because they would have thought, we got a sale.
Yes.
Oh, but it is beautiful. You know, that photograph just shows the bluest sky blue, the most intense aqua blue that you've ever seen. It's just glorious and so well cut as well. If you had it, what would you make out of it? Because I know it's sitting on your fingers here and it's covering up almost an entire length of knuckle.
Yes.
So half your hand has disappeared.
I think it would have to be a pendant. Yeah, I think it would be too big for a ring. And also I'd be worried that, you know, I'd knock it on something. If I had it as a pendant, I'd feel it was, you know, much more protected. But yeah, yeah. I could just imagine having it as a drop, you know, maybe with a few little accent stones or something, but, you know, nothing that would take away. That would be definitely the star of the show.
Yeah, I can see why that's definitely in your vault. Well, that's three just stunning gems and jewels. So tell us, what is item four? It's not actually one item, is it?
No, so it's more, I guess, the grouping. So it's a bonitoite gemstones. So bonitoite, again, it's another one of my favourite gems. It's quite a rare gemstone. A lot of people haven't heard of it. It's a barium titanium silicate mineral. And it's only really found in gem quality in one location, and that is from the San Benito County in Southern California, which is where it's named after. So again, this was a gemstone that I was introduced to while I was working for the mineral dealers. Obviously, the American dealers based in California. And again, I think my interest in it was because it was blue, but also because bonitoite has very high dispersion. So you can see the beautiful rainbows, the fire in these gemstones in the picture. So its dispersion is, you know, close to that of diamond. Although sometimes when you get the darker blue colours, you know, that can mask the dispersion. So, yeah, so I think that's where my interest came. I was like, oh, well, it's like having a blue sapphire, but with the fire of diamond.
Yeah.
So I thought, yeah, fabulous. So I actually have my wedding ring is set with bonitoite gemstones. Something a bit different. So I, you know, bought the gemstones and had it made up. So, yeah, I'm not sure if you can see it through the camera there.
Oh, I wish you could. No, I can't really see through the camera. You might have to send a sneaky bonus picture of that. Because I don't think I've ever seen a wedding ring with a bonitoite set into it, let alone a little collection of them. So good for you. That's the mark of a true connoisseur.
Yes. So the collection of gemstones here, so again, this was at the Munich show. This was in 2017, and every year they have special exhibits with lots of different gems and minerals from around the world, depending on what the theme is for the year. And this particular year, they had a whole case of bonitoites, and the best bonitoites in the world. So you can see here this collection of cut gemstones. So the trillionth, the one at the back, is in fact the world's largest faceted bonitoite gemstone. So it's 15.42 carats. So not a particularly big gemstone. And bonitoites, the majority of them are less than one carat. And this is partly due to the crystals, the sort of a triangular, like a sort of flattened triangular shape. And it's also strongly pleochroic. So the way they need to orientate the gemstone within the rough in order to get the best blue colour means that you end up with sort of very small gemstones. So to have one that's over 15 carats is quite incredible. And the kite-shaped one, which is just to the left of that in the image, is the second largest, and I think that is 10.47 carats.
Wow.
That one there. And then I also sent through a photo of the whole display case, and in that you can see this magnificent bonitoite and diamond necklace. And in fact, I was just flipping through an article on gemstone gemology from 1997, which talks about bonitoite, and it has pictured in it these two gemstones and also the necklace, and it credits them at the time to Michael Scott. So again, I'm not sure if they're still in his collection, but more magnificent jewels that part of his gem and mineral collection.
Yeah, he must have so many of the best, the tops, the biggest, the whatever. It would be anyone's guess what's in there. Maybe one day I'll get to ask him to pick six.
Yes, be fabulous.
On this podcast that he would be willing to share, because he must have some real treasures. Wow. Well, look, thank you so much. We haven't had any bonitoites on the podcast yet. So it's lovely that you shared your enthusiasm with this beautiful gem and explained a little bit more about it. And it is the most beautiful. I mean, these I love the party coloured ones that you've chosen as well. And it's really nice to see in the display case some rough, which displays that habit that you've mentioned. So, yeah, it's very special.
Yeah, beautiful gemstone, really is.
That's four fabulous picks for your fantasy vault. We've got the mystic quartz, well, mystic paste pendant.
Mystic paste.
We've got the carved agate mouse who's skating serenely and at speed across the rock crystal ice. We've got this fabulous Pariba tourmaline, which is the bluest blue and biggest drop. So, you know, that was a fabulous pick. And now we've got an entire caseload of Bonita White gems. So what is item five? I think I'm going for something bigger and even more beautiful.
So for the last two I've chosen are both from the collection at the Natural History Museum, which I'm really honoured to be able to look after. So for jewel number five, I've chosen a Morganite gemstone. So it's 598.7 carats. So it measures 5.1 centimetres across. And we believe it's the largest flawless faceted Morganite in the world. And it is just absolutely stunning. It's that proper bubblegum pink colour and, yeah, just so sparkly and fabulous. We have it on display in our vault gallery if you get the chance to come and have a look at it. So the photo I've sent now is from it on display.
Mm-hmm. And so that's in the vault part of the, which is at the back of the mineral gallery, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, and that is as close as most people will ever get to walking inside a jewel vault.
Yes. So it's, it's lovely. So Morganite, of course, is the pink variety of beryl, and it was first discovered in 1910 in Madagascar. And this gemstone comes from Madagascar, and we acquired it in 1913. So only 3 years after Morganite was, you know, officially discovered and named, which is quite exciting. So it's one of the great things about working with the collection is it's so historical, but you can look back and find, you know, these really interesting stories behind the gemstones, or also looking at the dates of acquisitions when they came into the collection, you can kind of see this history of when different gems were found and when they were found in different locations around the world. So, yeah, so this is, yeah, not only an amazing gemstone, but, you know, a very early on one that was found as well.
Mm. And you, being the curator of this fabulous collection, you have access to all the archives and all the stories, so you can share and wonder at that as well. So why have you chosen this Morganite, apart from the fact that it's very beautiful? Because, you know, this is a piece that you must walk past most days. So why have you chosen to put it into your own fantasy jewel vault? If it suddenly isn't on display, will we know where to go?
Possibly. Well, it has in fact just been off display for a couple of years. It was part of the museum's Turing Treasures exhibit, which left, I think, in 2018, 2019, and has been around the world on display there. So we've only just received it back, and it's only just gone back on display in the last month or so. But when it came back and we sort of received the box back and we opened the lid and it was sort of, you know, white plasterzote inside, and there was just almost like this beam of pink loveliness that kind of came shooting out of the box. It was just so glorious. And then to put it back on display in the vault where we've had a, you know, a gap for it for the last couple of years, and it's sitting next to a large Morganite crystal. It's just magnificent. And every time I walk past it, it just made me feel so happy to look at it. I thought, I definitely have to include this.
So it is crystallized joy. I love that. That's wonderful. What a description. Oh, thank you for choosing that. And so, again, I'm going to ask you the same story, because you obviously have a penchant for setting gems that you like. So how would you set this particular beauty? It's enormous.
It is enormous. In fact, I think it probably is almost too big to set.
No.
Definitely too big for a ring. So, yeah, I think, yeah, it would have to be some sort of, yeah, I think a large necklace, or, you know, I don't know, just the weight of it, I think, and it's just so big. Yeah, I'd have to consider it carefully.
It would look great with a Pariba tourmaline too.
Yes, it would.
Imagine those colours.
Oh, right next to each other.
Showstopping. Wow, OK. Okay, well, that's a great choice. So I completely see why you've chosen this for your fantasy vault. And the final piece, we've got this one space left. So tell us, what is number six?
So number six is a chrysoberyl. It's the Hope chrysoberyl. It's almost 45 carats. We also have it on display in the vault gallery. And it's a circular, brilliant cut. And again, it's just a really beautiful stone. So historically, this was one of the finest chrysoberyls known, and it belonged in the collection of Henry Philip Hope, who most people would know of as being the former owner of the Hope Diamond, which of course is the blue diamond now in the Smithsonian's collection. And so we have it on display, and I think it's just got this really wonderful lemony lime colour. But I think a lot of people actually overlook it, because as you walk past the case, it's in, you've got sort of imperial topaz and tourmaline and opals and all these other magnificent gems as well with it. But when you really look at it, it's just such a bright, lively stone and this wonderful colour. And also, again, going back into the archives, so Hope's collection was catalogued by a gentleman, Bram Hertz, and it was published in 1839, which is actually the same year as Hope's death. And it was figured and catalogued and numbered as chrysolite number one. And it has this absolutely beautiful description. In fact, if we've got time, I'll read you the description from the catalogue.
Please. Yes.
A most superb chrysolite, nearly of circular form and of a deep yellowish green tint, approaching the colour of peridot and most admirably cut like a brilliant. This extraordinarily fine gem is of the greatest transparency and brilliancy and free from any speck or flaw. Its uncommonly large size and great perfection entitle it to be called a matchless specimen.
Well, I think that's an apt description, isn't it?
I think it's just beautiful. I'm also quite pleased as a curator, I don't need to write descriptions like this for every gemstone, because it's just so wonderfully, you know, written. I don't think I'd be able to live up to that.
So it's matchless, yes.
Yeah. So again, it just has that wonderful history to it. So after Hope died in 1839, the specimen was passed through the family, and then it was auctioned by Christie's in 1866. And it was purchased by the mineral dealer James Reynold Gregory. And possibly he was purchasing it on behalf of the museum, because it then came directly into the collection from him. The other really cool thing is that one of my predecessors had done some research looking in the archives, and we have a letter that's dated in 1821 from a gentleman, Henry Hewland, who was a mineral dealer, to Edward Thornton, who was the minister for Portugal. Now, Hope had purchased lots of gem minerals from Hewland, including a very fine Brazilian chrysoberyl rough, for which he paid £250. Now, according to this letter, it produced a 44-carat gemstone. And so we think this has to be this gemstone, because this one is you know, just under 45 carats. So, you know, by looking at that as well, we can sort of infer that it probably means that this gemstone came from Brazil and that would have been cut either in 1821 or before that date. So it's just really lovely that we can kind of work out all this extra history about these gemstones. You know, it's not just a chrysoberyl we have on display. It's just got all this whole story behind it, which is really, really lovely.
Yes, and can you imagine the extraordinary reception of a gem this size from a new source? You know, because the discovery of the gem fields in Brazil really completely revolutionized jewelry history, didn't it? You know, in the preceding 50 years. So to have a gem of this size and then to have it cut in such a, you know, well, it's nearly circular. Well, it looks circular from here, but to have it cut almost like a brilliant, they must have required a considerable amount of skill. So it should have probably went to a very good stone cutter. Well, it's wonderful that you have all of this provenance, because this is what must be one of the great joys of your job, your current role.
It is. I do love it. I'm really interested in the historical side of the collection. And when you find, you know, these sort of tidbits of interest and every specimen we have, I mean, the mineral collection itself is about 180,000 specimens. So within
really?
That, yes. And we're actually one of the smallest collections in the museum. There's over 80 million objects in the museum itself.
So I would hate to do your stock takes.
Well, I did work out when I started, if I stay in this role until I retire, I don't think I can physically look at every single specimen we have in the collection. Like, there just isn't enough time.
Oh, isn't that tragic? Can you imagine? Well, I'll have to get you on in a few years then, and you'll have a totally new vault.
And to see, yeah, all the new things I might have uncovered.
So what is it you're currently working on? Because, you know, the last 2 years have obviously been a major issue for, you know, sharing the collection. But have you had some projects that you've been working on meantime?
Yes. So, I mean, we do a range of things. So we're looking ahead in the sort of the next 2 years. We're going to be doing some gallery enhancement projects. So looking at sort of, you know, just improving some of the galleries, the look and feel, updating labels, that sort of thing. So that's always a really exciting program to work on. And then other things that I do in my role, so, you know, registration of new specimens. So obviously we haven't had too many new specimens in the last couple of years because we haven't had the opportunity to go out looking for them. But certainly that's another part of my role. And then I'm also doing quite a bit of work with the gem collection, again, sort of trying to enhance what we've already, like all the information that we've already got on it. So the gem collection itself is about 4,500 specimens. And we sort of say if it's being cut and faceted and it's used for adornment, then that's what defines it as being part of the gem collection. But that we also have a lot of worked objects as well. So different carved bowls and vases and that sort of thing. So, yeah, so it's making sure they're all appropriately housed, you know, so that they're protected and preserved for the future and that they're available for research. And then we're adding new information about the specimens as we sort of learn anything new about them, or, you know, uncovering this kind of historical information as well, just adds so much more to each specimen.
Yeah, the wealth of detail. And so have you got any items on a shopping list for the Natural History Museum gem collection?
Well, the big
would
one...
That would be telling.
No.
Don't give the game away.
Well, a big Paraiba tourmaline is definitely at the top of my wish list because we don't have a Paraiba gemstone in the collection. So that's certainly... something that we'd love to get. A lot of the new acquisitions that we've been doing have been sort of interesting, rare or unusual gemstones. So in fact, in the last couple of years, we purchased a faceted gemstone, which is made of halite. So that's rock salt, so your normal table salt. So incredibly difficult material to work with because it dissolves in water. So, you know, they had to come up with a special method of faceting it using, I think it was using acetone or something like that on the cutting wheel. So we've bought some really interesting and unusual sort of gemstones, quite rare materials that you wouldn't normally think of for gemstones as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely a Paraiba. That's top of my list for the collection.
But I hope you've got deep pockets for a Paraiba tourmaline that would be worth displaying, because they're very expensive now. I've got a number of clients who should have bought them when they first came out. And, you know, the lack of material now for these really intense colours is, it's dwindled. They tend to be treated, don't they? So,
yes, yeah. And I think it is amongst the highest per carat value of many gemstones, I think, the Paraiba tourmalines, especially if they're untreated.
Yeah, well, all of the gems that you've chosen are pretty pricey, aren't they?
Yes. So, you
know, a good specimen.
Yes.
Or a matchless specimen would be very pricey. So we've come to the bit where I have to ask you the worst question of all, because out of these six amazing objects, you have to just choose one if all else was going to be lost, you know. So if we run through what you've put in already, you've got your mystic pendant, the gem that sparked your lifelong career and love of gems and minerals. We've got the carved agate mouse. We've got the Paraiba tourmaline, the Benitoite display of gems, the Morganite gem, which is just put back safely in the vault recess of your own museum, and the Hope Crystal Barrel, which is one of its mates. What would you choose if you could have any one of them?
It is such a hard decision, but I think I would have to go for the Morganite gemstone. But it's just so incredible, especially when you see it in person. Yeah, it's just stunning.
And it would light you up with its rays of joy every time you looked at it.
It would. Yeah. It really would.
Oh, well, I love that. I love the fact that you've chosen that. So thank you for sharing. It's just been a joy speaking to you.
Oh, thank you. No, it's been a real pleasure. I mean, I do love talking about gemstones, I have to say. So, yeah, no, it's been a real pleasure to be able to share them as well.
Well, it's been a real honour. So thank you so much for sharing the time and this amazing vault with us.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we did recording it. You can find images of all the wonderful pieces we've been talking about, along with lots more information at our website. Just go to insidethejewelvault.com/podcast. And I want to hear from you. Tell me, what special pieces would you put into your fantasy jewel vault and why? Every so often, I'll be collecting your stories into a podcast of their own, so please get in touch. And of course, rate, review, and subscribe so we can keep these conversations as meaningful and joyous as we can. Thank you.